Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, the unscripted show that celebrates unsung heroes, myth busts historical lies, and rediscovers the forgotten stories that changed our world. I'm your host, Scott Rank. I'd like to start off this episode by giving you a fact about Genghis Khan. There's a lot you might have heard about him. He was a ruler. He controlled much of Eurasia. The wars in his name led to the deaths of 40 million people. But what's fascinating is that he is the only recorded person in history who successfully engineered global cooling. Here's what I mean by that. Genghis and his descendants killed so many people that there were millions of acres that were left untended as farmland and reverted back to forest land. Because of that, ecologists found that this removed nearly 700 million tons of carbon from the atmosphere. So you don't have to get into the 21st century to find human impact on the climate. You can go back to the time of Genghis. Well, this fact is interesting, but it fits with what we understand about him, that he was a bloodthirsty ruler who threatened to destroy not just Europe, but also China. Other steppe nomads like Attila the Hun have this reputation as being the scourge of God that can fascinate us and repel us. But I'm going to talk to somebody who can give a different perspective about the barbarian empires of the steppes, and that is Professor Kenneth Harrell. Professor Harrell has a course with the Great Courses called The Empires of the Steppes, and what he does is look into these empires and try to understand how these civilizations existed, how they grew up, how they used campaigns of terror to sweep across the Eurasian steppes, toppling empires and seizing control of civilizations. But we also discuss positive contributions, how the Mongols created a pan-Eurasian network that united technologies, cultures, and literatures from China all the way to Europe, did much to architect the construction of the modern world, and had impact in ways we can't even possibly imagine. With all that said, please enjoy this interview with Dr. Kenneth Harrell. Ken, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much, Scott. I'm glad to be of help.
Absolutely. And there are a lot of questions I want to ask you because I'm interested in steppe nomadic cultures. I know a lot of other people are based on what I've seen with book buying habits and general interest. And you teach a course, so I'm sure you see that as well. And I want to start off with a question that I think I've seen on History Channel episodes and definitely amongst Mongolian fanboys in online forums about history. And that's about, did the Mongols and also the Huns have a reasonable chance of conquering Europe? Attila the Hun was on the precipice of doing so in the 5th century, and famously the Mongols were preparing an invasion of Europe in the 13th century before a Kudeltai happened, a large meeting, and the advance, Batu's advance, was halted. But do you think it could have happened? And if it did, what do you think would have happened?
Well, why don't we take them chronologically? Let's do the Huns first. The Huns were in a situation in 452, after their second invasion of the Western Roman Empire, that they could have mounted another expedition in the following year. And Attila, just like Genghis Khan, had had something like a 15-year run of extraordinary conquests, and he was now on the brink of bringing the Roman Empire of the West into some kind of an alliance. And it would not be an outright military conquest, but he insisted that an appeal from the sister of the Western Roman Emperor, Valentinian III, her name is Honoria, was to be his wife, that she had made a marriage proposal. The sources are unclear whether it was actually a marriage proposal or just a rescue appeal, and that half of the dowry should be, or the dowry should be half of the Roman Empire of the West. And that would essentially be what becomes the core of Western Europe in the Middle Ages. This was unacceptable to the imperial court. They rejected it. The result was war. And I have my own theories on why Attila took such offense about that. And a large amount has to his steppe background, what he expected from the Western government. And I often put it to my students, well, what would have happened if there was a marriage? And one of the arguments could be made that the Western Roman Empire might have been regenerated. that the nomadic conquerors would be accommodated as a new military elite, and they would hold in check many of the Germanic tribes that have already settled in the western provinces. And it may have extended the life of the Western Empire. Would it have ensured the endurance of the Roman Empire in one fashion or another for another 500 years? I doubt it. I think the Western Empire had so many fiscal and social problems that even with a period of a Hun military alliance or marital alliance, that it might forestall, might retard, but it would not prevent the eventual breakup of the Western Empire. The defeat or the repulse of the Huns, they weren't really defeated. They really just retreated. That ensured that the Germanic tribes would succeed to the Western Roman Empire's legacy rather than the Huns. And so I think that what if would change events tactically in the immediate, but in the long term, I don't think it would have had that much of an impact, given the fact that the Western Empire is in such difficulty. And the second thing is Attila left no successor. There was not anyone of his caliber, and this is quite in contrast to the Mongols, who, you know, Genghis Khan left three absolutely brilliant grandsons who have to rank on par with him. And they had a much larger empire and a much stronger institutional base they had gotten from contact with the Chinese and limited contact with the Islamic world. So that's my opinion on the Huns. It's a great what-if scenario, and when I offer it to my students, the students are just repulsed. Oh, my gosh, you're going to marry a Roman empress to a Hun emperor? I mean, you can't do this. And they're, of course, arguing from the Roman viewpoint.
Right.
Honoria may well have wanted the idea. I don't know. We have no idea. Her other option was to marry a very elderly and boring senator, so Attila may have looked good. yeah, at least it would have been exciting. And on the other hand, the second case you brought up with Batu's suspending operations and retiring first to Sarai on the Volga and then finally to participate in the election of the next Khan. That is a more difficult question to answer. It comes in two parts of the what if. Was it possible for them to do it? Could they conquer what was then the Holy Roman Empire, embracing Central Europe and Italy, France, a good part of it actually held by the King of England, the Spanish kingdoms, could all of them, and the Scandinavian kingdoms, could all of these areas be brought into some kind of tributary status the way Russia was? And I don't think it could have been done immediately. I think by the time they had finished off the Hungarian kingdom and had danced all over the Poles and Germans, that they had more or less reached their military logistical limit, and for conquest, they would have to sit down and really figure out how to operate in the densely wooded areas of Europe, heavy with cities, and posing all sorts of logistical problems the way China did on the eastern end, and it would have been a real jump. If the Mongols had conquered this area and subjected it to the kind of tributary status that they could to the Russian principalities, you would have gotten a very different history in Western Europe. You would not have seen the same kind of political institutions emerging under the tutelage of the Mongol Khans. I just don't believe that would have happened. On the other hand, they would have promoted trade and prosperity. There would have been a lot of technological change. But in the political sphere, I think you would be looking at a very different system, assuming they could do it. And so I think in terms of potential impact in world history, the Mongols play a much greater role than the Huns do. I think the Huns could only have forestalled the inevitable collapse of the Western Roman Empire, whereas the Mongols, if they could have achieved not a conquest in the sense they set up provinces, but imposing the tributary status they did on the Russian principalities, if they could have done that, it would have changed the history of Europe significantly. The same comes, what if they had defeated the Mamluks at Ain Jalut.
Right.
You know, what would have happened to the Sultan Sultanate at Cairo? Which becomes one of the key axes for the Islamic world in the 13th century, and then Constantinople in the 15th century is added by the Ottomans. You know, it would have really changed the face of Islam. Islam would have receded to the Maghreb and the Arabian Peninsula. And again, it's often fun in revisionist scholarly history to downgrade military events, but that battle was very, very significant for the Islamic world. Even though they didn't defeat a very effective Mongol army, Hulagu and most of the forces had withdrawn, its subordinate commanders, but nonetheless, the defeat was significant. The Mongols never returned. So the Mongols, to me, have a much, much greater potential impact than the Huns did. That's just my opinion. No disservice to Attila. I mean, he pulled off some extraordinary achievements. He's the first barbarian conqueror who ever really dictated treaties to the Roman Empire, and that's alone going to get him high marks, at least in the military diplomatic side of things.
I want to ask you more about this administrative evolution from Attila to Genghis, but one other thing there with Hulagu, he's a fascinating figure as well. And another thing I've seen with revisionist history is the effect of the Mongol invasions on the Islamic world. And there were a number of Nestorian Christian wives amongst Mongolian leaders and generals. And I think, was it Hulagu's son who was married to a Byzantine princess?
I believe that's right. She's from, Trebizond, yeah.
Yeah, from Mary of the Mongols.
Yeah, Mary of the Mongols, yeah. Yeah. And
has that church in Istanbul.
Yeah, yeah, that's exactly right. She's part of the Paleogan dynasty, yeah.
There was some people wonder if, you know, if the Mongols had converted to Nestorian Christianity, what effects would that have been? And
well, that would pose a real dilemma for the lands of Eastern Islam because, you know, you would have Dimi ruling over you in a way that, you know, the Mongols are Gavor. I mean, they're heathens.
Yeah.
You can put up with them, and there's the potential of getting them on the right path. But to go over to Christianity like that would be that would have posed, I think, strains on the loyalty of the Muslim subjects, and none of them did. And I think it's because the Islam they encountered, the Mongols encountered, was so pervasive culturally that remarkable Turkish-Persian amalgam of Eastern Islam, that they were easily seduced that, well, this is the imperial culture. Just as in China, the Confucian culture of the Song, this is the imperial culture. And if we're going to rule as serious rulers and we're going to move away from traditional beliefs, this is the one we should opt for. I mean, I just think on pragmatic terms, that's what they would have done. I think a conversion to Nestorian Christianity by someone like Hulagu or one of the Ilkhans, that would not have gained him that much advantage in running that state in Eastern Islam. And in the central areas, lands where Jagatai ruled along the Silk Road, the Nestorians are clearly a subordinate religion. They're protected, but they have no serious cultural and administrative elite. And so I don't think it would have happened. That's just my opinion, again, on a what if. And it wouldn't have had a lasting impact. It may well have precipitated the fall of the Ilkhanate sooner than it did. On the other hand, the attraction of Islam is all powerful and understandable. Now, its effect on the Islamic world is, what did they suffer from the Mongol conquest and rule? Well, that's a different story. That really It really shattered the Islamic world. It changed the axis of power. Is no longer Baghdad. It moves west, and that's easily traced. But your question, I never thought of. Quite honestly, I never thought of that question as a what if question. So you've got me on the ropes here. The best I can come up with is probably wouldn't have lasted any more than the conversions that were done in China under the Mongols, the later Yuan emperors. You know, you have an imperial prince who embraces Catholic Christianity. There are missionaries. The Nestorians are sending back these sanguine reports. Oh, the Mongols are going to convert. Cathay is going to go Christian. And what happened is once the Ming take over, this just disappears. I mean, it just collapses. It's not part of the imperial tradition. And it's a foreign religion, and it has its place, but it's not got a place in the ruling culture and the ruling elite. So I think my suspicion is what happened in China at Christian efforts, the same would have happened in Eastern Islam.
Well, it's so easy to get tangled up in these hypotheticals because of the earth-shattering changes that happened under them.
Yeah, and the best one is Batu. If the Mongols could have said, if they prioritized, is that horrible word they use in strategy, if they had put Western Europe above China, now I don't know any sane person who would have done that in the 13th century, but if you had prioritized Western Europe over China and you made all of the provisions of equipping your armies with the local populations, the infantry and all that you would need to conquer China, to conquer Western Europe, you probably could have done it. But given the resources and the distances and just the sheer fact that China is worth so much more to the Mongols than Western Europe, I mean, just look at the envoys who come. You know, the Western Europeans send these barefooted monks with shabby gifts, whereas the Chinese show up offering silk. I mean, come on. The envoys alone give you an idea of the power relationship there. So they could have done it, and it would have been a significant change, I think. I really do. Those nascent monarchies and the commune movements of late medieval Italy would never have gone the way they did, which produced the political order of Western Europe. You would have seen much more autocratic rule along the lines of what happened in the Russian principalities.
Just kind of stepping away from the hypothetical into the practical, you mentioned that it would be challenging to push into Western Europe because of the nature of steppe nomadic warfare, the use of multiple remounts. Let's go back to the beginning of steppe nomadic culture. And I mentioned steppe nomadic military tactics because I'm surprised at how much it seems like chroniclers of steppe nomads are saying the same things, whether you have Herodotus in the 5th century BCE,
right,
up to the Byzantines, up to the Russians, 1,500 years later, 2,000 years later almost. Can you talk about the origins of steppe nomadic culture, their connection to horses? They're called horse nomads sometimes, and why it would be challenging for them to go to a place like Western Europe when they can do so well on the vast expanses of Eurasia.
Yeah, well, you're right. Militarily, they're absolutely invincible until you, on the Eurasian steppes, until the Russians can get their act together with handheld firearms and artillery. And that's what finally does them in on their homeland. They're greeted with far more effective firepower than their bows can. And up until perhaps the 16th century, even the 17th century, they still dominate. And the Russian czars are still, they're still fielding Turkmen allies in Eastern Russia, in the 18th century, armed with the classic bows. They're called in at points to put down the great rebellions of Pukhachev, the great peasant revolts in the late 18th century. So as warfare goes, the creation of that composite bow and combination with the improved saddles, which has certainly been perfected by the 5th century AD and goes back at least to the 5th century BC, saddles may not be as good, but the techniques are still there. You're looking at a run of some 2,000 years where on open spaces, no one can challenge a nomadic army properly equipped and trained. And these are people who learn horse riding from birth. The horses are adapted to the conditions. They can forage in the winter under the snow. They are the source of mare's milk and the fermented drinks that they're always swearing alliances with the Kumish or Gumish, as it's in Mongolian. And that gave them an immense advantage in that great heartland that they could never really be attacked or conquered. The closest was the first Tang emperors of China in the early 7th century are able to impose a kind of hegemony over the eastern steppes. It's not direct rule, and no Chinese government came that close. Usually these are alliances in which the Chinese emperor says, you render me tribute and horses and the like, and then you get gifts in return. And undoubtedly the steppe nomads had the attitude is, the Chinese emperor is buying our support. I mean, the perceptions on both ends probably are quite different. So militarily, they're really unchallenged. Once they move out of their homeland, the natural terrain that supports it, and they get into urban areas, heavily irrigated agricultural zones, then they have to supplement their army. They don't have to replace it, but they need infantry. They need engineers. They need people who can take cities. Genghis Khan learns this early in his career. He's thwarted in several important early sieges, and then he has a permanent corps of Chinese engineers, which becomes a feature of all Mongol armies in the 13th century. And with Hulagu, they then start adding experts from the Islamic world. So in that score, that's been a feature of their warfare since the time of Herodotus. And you can understand it because their whole life is based on moving animals across those vast grasslands. And they could travel great distances very quickly, establish new homelands, quote unquote, exploit the area. They understood the seasonal patterns. Furthermore, the nature of their existence requires them to trade with sedentary civilizations for fruits, vegetables, grain products. They're trading different types of milk, cheeses, hides, animal meat with the sedentary populations. And merchants are constantly among them, and they have more information of trade routes and the overall geography of their world by the time of Genghis Khan than anyone else. Probably no one understands Eurasia as a continent better than the Mongols in the 13th century. Everyone else, in their view, is living on the fringes of this vast Eurasian steppe. And again, that's part of their way of life. They're in constant contact with different civilizations, adapting, and they are very well informed. That's even true of someone like Attila the Hun, who still, in my opinion, there's a lot of revisionist scholarship on this, is still very much a steppe nomadic conqueror. And again, getting information from merchants. He is extremely well informed of what the Roman Empire, the Eastern and Western Empire, are doing. And he can time his attacks to full advantage. And this is the same thing that Genghis Khan can do. And that's a result of their way of life. So the warfare very much reflects the way of life and gives them this immense advantage.
Could you describe also the military tactics that would be used? And I know most of what we know comes from Genghis Khan's time, and it's different from Attila, but remounts they would use, how they would do these hit and run or archery tactics, everything else?
Yeah, actually, we've got enough. We've got great stuff from Genghis Khan's time. And you have the secret history of the Mongols. You have two important Muslim histories that are written within about a generation of his death, based on eyewitness reports. So the details of the campaigns in Transoxiana are very well recorded. Chinese accounts give us detailed reports of what's going on. But we also have very important Byzantine late Roman military manuals, starting with the Strategon, attributed to the Emperor Maurice Tiberius, Tatang generals on how to handle early Turkish nomads. And this is almost contemporary with the Byzantine. And the tactics all point to a highly mobile foe, capable of using somewhere between 5 and 10 remounts, and constant skirmishing tactics where they come out of nowhere and hit their slow-moving opponents. Usually what happens is the opponent is forced to move out of a line of march into a line of battle. It is difficult to keep men disciplined, especially if they're not that well trained, from going after a retreating foe. There's nothing more inviting to soldiers than to see your opponent flee, to turn his back. And what happens is the foe will then charge. The cavalry will go in the lead. The infantry is much slower. They'll start to break up. And this is all feigned retreat, in which the light cavalry, whether they're Turkish or Mongol, then turn on their opponent. And other forces appear to flank and encircle. And they defeat the opponent in detail, wearing him down. Sometimes you get strategic running battles. This is very much the case of Muslim armies trying to conquer Transoxiana in the 8th century, where Turkmen cavalry called in by the great caravan cities could wear a Muslim army down in a matter of several weeks of fighting. And eventually the army just disintegrates because it's under the constant attack. The only way to counter them in a very, very set battle is you have to have close coordination between your cavalry and your infantry. You have to have a lot of missile weapons of your own. That's why the Chinese invent crossbows. Crossbows are, you know, I was just in Seattle with my wife, and I saw the Terracotta Army, which is on display, or examples of it from the tomb of Qin Shi Huangdi, the first Chinese emperor, 221 to 208 BC. And you already have wonderful life-size models of these Chinese crossbowmen who are able to be trained rather rapidly and fight as infantry. And they can outdistance the composite bows of the nomadic foe. These would be the Shuang Nu in the time of the Qin dynasty. And but again, it requires immense discipline, and it's easy for those armies to break up. And the best you can achieve is you're not defeated. That is, you drive the foe off, but you haven't destroyed them. And then when you try to attack the homeland, the Chinese do this repeatedly in the Han Empire, they scatter. You can take winter camps, perhaps. You'd have to drive off large herds of horses. Usually the best way of dealing with steppe nomads is to encourage war within the confederation. All of these nomadic empires or confederations of different tribes, and you always have the inner tribes and the outer tribes, and the outer tribes are exactly that. They're out. The inner tribes are in. They get the goodies. And the best way to go at it is diplomatically. You know, the Chinese have the five baits, where they get these local rulers addicted to Chinese wives and silk and all sorts of goods, and then encourage them with titles to turn on their rivals. And this is what the Jin emperors initially tried to do with Genghis Khan. They tried to encourage other tribes to oppose him, and by 1206, that game was no longer there because Genghis had united all the tribes. And so the most effective way, really, of countering nomadic invaders was diplomatically. That's what happens to Attila's empire. The Eastern Roman Emperor Marcian encourages the various vassals and the competing sons and nephews of Attila to fight a civil war, which sees the breakup of the Hun Confederation. they're not defeated in a major pitched battle. And the Hun homeland is not invaded any more than the Mongol homeland was invaded. So militarily, they're very, very successful in that regard. They can be checked, but not defeated.
Right. It's that same flexibility that allows them to maneuver also means a lack of cohesion in their society. But what you said with armies trying to go after them, it can't help but be a war of attrition, because if you go in the homeland of people who are by their nature mobile, mm-hmm. they'll always move faster than you. If you're fielding a large army with all your baggage trains and all your supplies going in, they can move beyond your reach. You can't stop them.
That's right. And the infantry, as everyone, every commander, infantry are lazy. They always take this, they always want to march downhill. Then it's very hard to direct them. And you cannot move essentially an infantry army at any more than 12 to 15 miles a day is an average for any of these ancient or medieval armies. If you really pressed it, you could do 25 miles in a day. But that's a forced march, a magnum iter in Latin, and you can't sustain that for more than a couple of days, and then you're exhausted. You've got to rest your animals, your pack animals, and all. And Chinese and Byzantine armies and even the armies of Eastern Islam, which are very, very heavily infantry armies, they're recruiting all those Persians and Iranians into their ranks. They can't sustain that. They can garrison cities, they can impose certain control over crossings. And the Islamic world understood it immediately. In the 9th century, that begins the whole tradition of slave soldiers. You first recruit them to protect caravans. The Samanid emirs were very good at that. And then you start recruiting Turkic allies and slave soldiers from Eurasia for all sorts of Islamic states. They become the military elite. So if you want to counter them, you counter them with other nomads. And the Muslim polities were very good at doing that. Chinese did the same. You know, they had to recruit allies and acquire horses from the nomads. They can't sustain horses in their homeland. They just can't grow them strong enough. The soil conditions aren't right to give them type of fodder to get them strong bones. So you're really reduced to hiring these people. Encountering nomads with nomads. The other great thing about them is it's always forgotten how much, once peace is imposed in the 13th century in the Mongol Empire, when has Eurasia been so unified?
Right.
I mean, tell me, before or after? It certainly isn't today. What we're reading in the news, you know, everything from Korea to Turkey today. You know, there's some kind of regional conflict, local war, whatever. And all of those regions would essentially have been under the domain of the Khan or the Khan or the consortium of the Khans, and trade could proceed. Religious exchange could. Transfer of technology, all sorts of information could proceed. I mean, it was a very, very destructive set of wars. But on the other hand, for essentially, it achieved a unity and prosperity that world has never seen before or since, in many ways.
Right. At that time, you see these world travelers, Marco Polo, the most famous, but then Ibn Battuta, the chronicler.
Absolutely.
Rahman Bar Salma, the Chinese Turco-Mongolic Nestorian priest who goes to Europe. Yeah, but it's because of the Mongols and this sort of open system of trade.
Yeah, and with it, gunpowder is given to the Europeans, and you can see what happens with that. It's probably one of the few things they learned. the exchange of mathematics and medicine between the Islamic and Chinese world, there's all sorts of learned scholarship on that, how those two civilizations come into very close contact. The introduction of Chinese paper money, for instance, in Iran. a whole different concept. The introduction of paper, which is then carried to India by the Mughals and revolutionizes administration in the Indian subcontinent, because before that you're using palm leaf paper, which just disintegrates on you before you finish writing in some cases. I mean, I've seen it. It's very, very fragile. Whereas you could now produce documents and paper that could allow for very, very central administration in the Mughal Empire. So all of this is one way or the other complements of the Mongols. And the world would be different if we had not had that Mongol century, as I would call it. The 13th century is the Mongol century. If you're looking across, if you're space, here, you know, the favorite alien, you know, the aliens come in and create all these things, those silly theses. But if you were an alien coming to the globe in the year 1350, where would you go for the action? Where is the action on the planet? It's in the Mongol Empire. Yeah. Everything else is second. It's just obvious. It is certainly, you're not going to go to distant Japan. You're not going to go to the British Isles. Those islands have futures far in the future, really in the distant future. Their success will be in the distant future. In the 13th century, it's the Mongol Empire, without a doubt.
And I want to ask something about that specifically with this period you called the Mongol century. Probably one of the better known books about the Mongols is Jack Weatherford's Genghis Khan and the Making of the Modern World. And I know scholars have issues with it, but his thesis is part of it is what you just said, that because of the Mongols creating this Eurasian connection, it allowed a flow of commerce and ideas and technology that wasn't possible. Now, some would say that's just incidental of having a massive polity that brings together different cultures, not some, you know, grand multicultural design. But he almost seems to suggest that it's this multicultural outlook of the Mongolians, and there's a what he calls tolerance of allowing different religious groups into his empire. You could worship the way you want to. You weren't forced to convert, which, again, some people would argue that, well, that's true of almost any large empire, because when you're dealing with so many hundreds of religions and languages and cultures, that you have to give flexibility or the thing just won't stand. But he would say, well, no, it's incidental, this enlightened worldview. So what's your take on all of that?
Well, I would say it's pragmatic, your last point. In a period of conquest, there's a great deal of pragmatism in maintaining. You're busy conquering and you're not worried about administering yet. So you cut deals and arrangements with populations to minimize your foes and concentrate on your main foe. And that could be allowing religious systems to stay in place, previous administrative structure. I mean, the old adage told to Ogadai, you can't rule China from horseback. You've got to use Chinese bureaucrats to get things done. And so a great deal of that is pragmatism rather than any kind of higher policy of tolerance as we would understand it. And the word tolerance gets tossed around, and if I can just play classical philologist for a moment and annoy your listeners. Tolerance comes from the Latin verb tolere, third conjugation verb. It's actually irregular, and it means I suffer. It's its basic meaning as I suffer you to exist. I permit you. Don't like it, but I'm not going to injure you, and I'm not even admitting that what you believe or what you're practicing is legitimate, but I will allow it to go on. And it's not a policy that would suggest that they have a tolerant worldview and all of the religions, you know, are on equal footing. I think someone like Genghis just respected any holy one that could potentially, represent divine power. And that divine power could express itself as a Sufi mystic or a Buddhist monk, and that's fine for those cultures. I'll respect it. I don't want to get on the bad side of the divine powers, but I certainly believe in my shamans and in Tengri and the traditional god of the Mongol nation. And so in that regard, I fall more in the camp that this is a byproduct. of the pragmatism of the Mongols and their outlook on how are we going to manage this huge area that we've now brought under control. But that does not negate the impact. You can go on and criticize the Mongols as being extremely destructive and count up the number of lives that were apparently lost and the destruction of cities and the like. But the beneficial consequences, even if unintended, were significant and still reverberate today. So when you look at the Mongols, you have to understand them. Okay, what were they trying to achieve on their own terms? And these were the rules of the day. And yes, the Mongols practiced terror as a way to paralyze their foes on an unprecedented scale. And it's horrifying, clearly horrified Chinese, Muslim, and Christian writers all at the same time. But then what were the consequences once you submitted to the Mongol rule? What were the benefits of it? And once the conquest was over, or if you had surrendered on terms, well, there were many benefits to that rule. And that's why it lasted as long as it did. To me, it's amazing it lasted three generations. The empire more or less held together, maybe more as a consortia than an empire, whereas previous steppe empires usually rise and fall with the founder. Someone like Attila or Modu Chanu of the Xuannu in the early 2nd century BC, fighting the Chinese. And so, I think I would fall more on that camp rather than a coherent, you know, multinational, multicultural policy they had in mind. I think that's just an anachronism. I think if you went to Genghis Khan and said, you know, you're a multicultural guy, he'd probably look at you and say, "What are you talking about?" That's always my way of, you know, scholars like to dress up history so it sounds more profound than it often is, and I often ask my classes when they use large fancy terms and say, "Well, what does that actually mean?" What would you say to a Roman, or what would you say to a Muslim of the 7th century? I mean, would that even make any sense to them in those terms? And you always have to remember in approaching any historical period, especially one in the distant past with many different preconceptions and assumptions, you know, the very question you may be asking for those people at that time was either irrelevant or not particularly important. And you always have to keep that in mind when you're making some of these conclusions. Yeah, I see probably much more in the second camp. Yeah, the law of unintended consequences, which really affects not only history but all of our lives. I mean, right. I think any good I've done in my teaching career has probably been more unintended than actual. So
something you mentioned with thank you for describing all that, and I think framing something that's useful for the Mongols, but in fact, a lot of history where we are guilty of presentism and using terms that have a totally different meaning. Like you said, if you said Genghis, are you multicultural? He'd say, "Why, of course, I have wives and concubines of many cultures," and that's about as far as you go.
Yeah, and I learned some really useful phrases from my Nestorian wife. Yeah,
but this term,
I know how to talk to those bishops now.
Yeah. Right. I mean, the modern understanding of tolerance, I think where I see this mudslinging perhaps at the highest fever pitch is maybe Christians and Muslims might argue who is the most tolerant to religious minorities in the past. And I think, well, would you want to live as a minority at any time in the past, no matter how good it is? Probably not. But I'd like to ask
Not when you get the religions of Abraham. You know, once you make that change from to the monotheistic creeds of Western Eurasia, it's sectarianism enters into it, and that causes divisions that in the pre-Christian Islamic world you never had.
Right, where there are these sectarian issues that take on a whole meaning in the early modern period. I'd like to ask you about looking at these things from the vantage point of these steppe cultures. These periods in time, Attila, Genghis, others who are successful at these massive raids, accumulating extraordinary levels of wealth, what would be the purpose for a steppe nomad, horse nomadic culture of engaging in these large-scale raids beyond getting loot and plunder that allows someone to exceed their subsistence level, which a subsistence level is not very high if you're a nomad, and accumulating all this plunder for conspicuous consumption from a sedentary society that might not have as much value on the steppe? What do you think are the motivations behind these raids?
Well, I think along the border zones, the tribes that are in immediate contact with the sedentary population might be better described rather than foes as bitter friends. They need each other. The sedentary society provides some things, the nomadic culture others, and the preponderance of population and wealth is clearly on the side of the sedentary people. And when you can obtain it through favorable trade agreements, you raid. And then as you get more effective at raiding, you realize that you can certainly go well beyond just subsistence. You can now amass wealth and power that will allow you to exercise power over other tribes, and then it becomes a self-sustaining system, especially under charismatic ruler. The more we raid, the more we impose tribute, we reverse the relationship. We're now in the dominance. The Chinese emperor, the Roman emperor is paying us tribute, and we can get everything we want plus more. And then there's the intoxication that the ruling tribes are at the top of a imperial pyramid. And that's that ability to exercise power should not be dismissed. That's important. You've gone from, you think of Genghis, his father and his ancestors were nothing more than third-rate vassals of the Jin emperor, the Jurgen people from Manchuria who established this empire in North China, north of the Wang Ho. And now the situation by 1216 is reversed. I have captured the Jing capital. I am in charge. And I can exact all the wealth I want. So that would account for the raiding. And what other way can they acquire the goods? There's only so much you're going to be able to obtain in exchange for hides and furs and horses. And the nomadic people do not have a major technological advantage. It's not a question of the kind of global trade you have today, where some countries can get in on high tech and we can outsell opponents, et cetera, et cetera. That type of market has not yet exist. So that would account for the raiding. Then to go from raiding to empire building, very few can make that transition. It takes exceptional ruler and organization to do so. That's where your earlier question on tolerance, or I would call it pragmatism, comes in. The Mongols and the Huns both were able to employ people from the sedentary civilizations to run their empires more effectively, to shift from tribute to taxation, to provide engineering corps that could capture cities as well as build structures. They transformed themselves into something more than nomads. But again, that only happens in a few cases. Very often, these confederations break up in time. And that breakup is always encouraged by sedentary civilizations that feel threatened. Really, if you look at it from the nomadic side, the sedentary civilizations look far more threatening to them in many ways than the nomads do to the sedentary civilization. First, the disproportion of numbers. If it's at all accurate what we're told at the time of Genghis Khan's death, there's something like 130,000 potential nomadic warriors, Turk and Mongol, on the central and eastern steppes, presupposing a population of a million people. Well, what's the size of the Chinese Empire in 1225? 60 million? I mean, what's the size of the Islamic world? In terms of numbers, they are so outnumbered in comparison to the sedentary civilizations that they could feel threatened. Again, we always see it from, except for the secret history of the Mongols, we don't have anything written You have the Orkhon inscriptions of the Turks in the 8th century. We have almost nothing telling it from the Romantics' viewpoint. We're basing most of our observations from the sedentary civilizations, and they, of course, fear them. But the fear was on the other side, too, and that's often forgotten.
Yeah, I wondered that when you have a influential civilization that hasn't left behind a lot of writings of its own, mm-hmm. and you have to read from the other side, you're kind of like a Kremlinologist reading between the lines of Pravda to understand what's going on. How do researchers go about that to try to understand? Is it archaeology or other ways?
Only so much you can do. Archaeology helps in part. And my main scholarly training is in the classical world, and their archaeology can give some balancing. But part of it is just perspective. In my scholarly guise, as opposed to being more generalist, for instance, the reevaluation, I and a very dear colleague of mine at Chapel Hill are in a very small minority in which we argue that our understanding of Sparta is just completely warped. Athens is given an exaggerated position in the Western tradition, perhaps one of the most, or it's important, but it becomes overrated. And we almost think of Athenian civilization as Greek civilization. And all of our writings are by Athenians, and none of our writings are from Spartans. And one way to do it is by archaeology. Another is comparative approach. I've taught a course on the Punic Wars and the Peloponnesian Wars, and in the same seminar. And the logic is these are the two best recorded courses from classical antiquity, wars from classical antiquity, and all four belligerents were republics or democracies. No kings were involved. When you do that, you begin to see Sparta in a very, very different light in comparison to Athens, Rome, and Carthage. And the opinion of Sparta increases. It's the head of a Peloponnesian League. The idea that it is the Marxist oppressive state with 90% of the population of slaves is probably just nonsense. And it comes off in a very different light. And if we usually, classicists, think the victory of the Spartans over the Athenians was a tragedy, but they hail the victory of the Romans over the Carthaginians. Well, if we had writers writing from the Spartans' perspective, we would be hailing Sparta the way we hail Rome. A land power defeated its traditional rival on its own element, the sea. And some of it is just by using comparative analogy and questioning the assumptions of the sources we have. Your point about the Kremlin or talking about Mao's China, you're getting everything from one side. Well, what does the other side probably see? And you force yourself to play reconstruction. That's one of the great things of the earlier periods of history. You've got these sources and, okay, this is one side of the story. Well, what's the other side of the story? And I always in my classes force my students to think that way. There's got to be at least two perspectives, maybe more, but at least two. And so archaeology, it can provide an enormous amount of information on material culture, social organization, political organization, but it can only go so far because you don't have writing. And until you can get to the real thoughts of these people, you can see their language. And you know as well as I do, as a fellow scholar, language is an interpretation of the world. You know, you hit a limit with physical archaeology at a certain point. So that would be my answer. And that's why history is constantly being reinterpreted. What was fine in the 19th century about the steppe nomads is completely inadequate for the 21st. Our understanding has changed. Our appreciation of events have changed. Other events have occurred that have caused us to reconsider what our sources tell us. And this goes on all the time. And that's great for both of us as historians. We'll always be in business.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I think I remember that in the 19th century with the whole great man approach to history, the Encyclopedia Britannica describing steppe nomads, all it does is give a biography of Attila the Hun. as if this encapsulation of everything, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And probably the sword of Mars has been thrown in too, right out of Priscus. And the Hungarian kings claiming descent. Yeah. Sounds right. But, that encyclopedia, for what it did at the time, was really amazing. I have a copy of it. I consult it for certain things all the time. For instance, for the medieval English constitutional history, it's one of the best.
Huh. Okay. I've got something still relevant.
What was of interest at the time and was covered, was really covered well. And there are a lot of things that are not covered, and then some of it, well, we could do much better. But when it came to texts, understanding texts, they really knew their languages, and so those type of articles would be very good. It's still a classic for certain information. But I didn't know that about steppe nomads. That sounds right, though.
Right. So, Ken, thank you for this overview. And I'd like to ask one other thing to tie in a lot of these themes together. Mm-hmm. Now you mentioned the challenges of studying steppe cultures because of our source base. And because we see this from the sedentary civilizations, they're painted as these raiders with no civilization of their own who pillage, burn, destroy. But what do we gain as students of history by understanding nomadic cultures of Attila, Genghis, and others?
Well, it's all a matter of gaining more perspectives on the way human societies can organize themselves, what assumptions they have, that there's generally no single explanation, and even the term of civilization can sometimes be called into question. Just because the population doesn't have writing, it doesn't necessarily mean they're stupid, which is an old assumption of the 19th century. They're illiterate. And that term is still used as an insulting term in daily language. You can see how different cultures express themselves. I always talk about the brilliance of steppe art, particularly in jewelry and fabrics, where their genius is focused on those miniature arts rather than on monumental architecture that tourists like to go to in the Mediterranean world. So it's just part of the whole fabric of human history. And while I had to choose to be a classical historian, all periods of history are of interest to me, and all peoples are of interest, because ultimately they're all part of the same story. You focus on different areas and times because of the information and your own limited abilities. There's only so much any one individual can master. But it all does fit together, and you can't explain one thing without another, and that's just seen if you want to simply cut yourself off in some kind of isolationist position. It's just not practical. There was in Toynbee's Study of History, and I only remember it very imperfectly. I read it many, many years ago. He raised that question. We can classify all these civilizations or cultures, but can we really understand any one of them alone? The answer is no. And he answers it, no, you can't. Ultimately, you have to have some understanding of all of it, and then focus on what you think you can contribute to our understanding. And so that would be my answer. The only record we have is what is past. We have no idea what the future is going to be, and the present is just a point, a brief moment in time between the past and the future. So if we're going to understand how to respond to our world, we have to see what the previous record is and see what the different possibilities and options were. And what I hope to train my students in is not just understanding the facts of the Roman Republic or the Byzantine world or the Mongol armies, but also how can you think in terms of possibilities and ambiguities, and how can you attain a sense of perspective of what the other side or sides might be thinking. And that's why you study history. That's and all history. And you're dealing with a very, very important part of the globe over a very long period, 2,000 years. It's extraordinary, really, when you think about it.
Yeah, and if you're talking about continuity between civilizations, these steppe nomads are definitely important connective tissue between different groups. So even beyond looking at them for themselves, how they connect with others. something very important.
Yeah.
Well, Ken, your course is on the great courses, the Barbarian Empires of the Steppes, which is very well rated amongst the history courses there. And I think a great place if people want to learn more about the things that you talked about here. Well, I really appreciate all this great overview you gave about steppe cultures. Mm-hmm. Really appreciate it, Ken. Thank you for joining us.
Well, I was glad to help. Anything to promote history is I'm in favor of.
Well, thank you for listening. Like I said, Dr. Hall has many courses on the teaching company, including the Barbarian Empires of the Steppes, which includes this episode's subject matter, but also courses on the ancient world, on the Ottoman Empire, and many other things, which I will link up to in the show notes for this episode. You can find all those things if you go to historyunplugpodcast.com. Thanks for listening. See you next time. Thanks for listening to the History Unplugged podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the show to get your daily dose of all things history related, from ancient Greece to the Cold War. You can do that by going to historyonthenet.com/subscribe. Speaking of History on the Net, if you want to dive deeper, go to our site, historyonthenet.com, and there you'll find blog posts, book reviews, and all of our other podcast episodes. Plus, don't forget to rate and review this podcast so we can bring you the best daily history content possible. We'll see you next time at the History Unplugged podcast.